You're listening to West Side Stories. Thanks for having me back. Back in the studio here for my third week of the show. This is the third rendition of the podcast with Ruth, who's a South Sudanese artist that works in an organization called Next in Color based on African dysphoria communities. And yeah, and I just want to give a shout out to all the communities out there that are dealing with the bushfires. It's, you know, a very hard time for people in this heat and the smoke as well for people, but also the fires. And a huge shout out to the CFA workers who, as I was talking with Maddie in the studio just before, are all volunteers and are running around doing this work and not being paid and just incredibly amazing. So yeah, big shout out to them. So yeah, today I'll be doing the third episode of the podcast series, and yeah, it'll be with Ruth. So let's have a listen. This podcast was recorded in Naam on the lands of the Wurundjeri and the Bunurong people of the Eastern Kulin Nations. Welcome to West Side Stories, a podcast dedicated to the voices of Melbourne's West. In this series, we speak with people who live, work, and create in the western suburbs. Community members, change makers, and artists who are shaping the culture and identity of the West. Today I'm speaking with Ruth, a South Sudanese multidisciplinary artist who uses her art to heal, understand the world around her, and create comfort in her blackness. Her work explores what it's like to be an African living in modern Australia. She's especially interested in decolonizing language, tone, and how we share perspectives instead of just blending in. Ruth is also the co-director of Next in Colour, a community-led organization that supports young people from African diaspora communities through contemporary art. I'm really excited to talk with her today, so let's get into it. Now, I just want to start off with a conversation about what is Next in Colour? How did it start? Where did it come from? What was the idea? And how has it evolved to today?
Yes. Well, Next in Colour started off as a collective.
Mm-hmm.
It was a collective of African community arts workers, facilitators that typically engage with co-health and arts generator downstairs here from Footscray Community Arts. And we happen to be in the same spaces talking about the same things about impact, social impact, community engaged practices through art making, because a lot of us were creative artists and we saw art making as a tool in building community, I guess, connections. And so we wanted to radicalize that idea of coming together as a collective and imagining a space. We didn't know what that space was going to be like. Yeah. This was 2018. This was pre-COVID.
Yep.
We were extremely ambitious. At that time, I was situated in the West. I'm from the Southeast. And I was...
We don't say that. We'll just pretend that that's not part of the case. No, that's fine. Yeah.
And we really wanted to create, I guess, a legacy or a footprint here in the Western suburbs, particularly because of the high representation of African communities here. And so we ended up, thank God, getting a state government funding.
Yeah, wow.
And that helped us for 3 years to really develop the foundational structures that we need to build, which at that time was Next in Colour was known as Colouring Between the Lines. And so over time through that, I guess, governance building, we were able to form Next in Colour, which then became and morphed itself as a community arts organization, where we sat in the intersections of non-profit and for-profit engagement. And through that, we were able to really develop and create a strategy around, I guess, creating this longevity and this space where, yeah, it's known now as Next in Colour.
Wow. That's so amazing. Like, so you just had an idea, an initiative, and then you thought, I'm just going to see what I can, where this can go and yes. where I can make it and see if there's a bit of money in this.
Yes.
And then from there it was like, boom, this is a whole new organisation. Do you feel like there was a real need in the West for that kind of space for those young people to have a creative outlet from the African dysphoria communities?
Definitely. The members at Next in Colour, we all have different, I guess, executive skills. We understand community engagement in a more complex, I guess, government and also academic structure.
Yeah.
And we were always engaging with different institutions as a consultant, as a facilitator, and not really creating real impact.
Yeah.
And so that hunger of us creating a space came from that need.
Yeah.
And we really wanted to figure out how to create that. And all of us had shared value in that space.
Yeah.
And how that space can look like.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was really just us trusting our own, I guess, determination of Amazing. Creating a community space.
Yeah.
And we're grateful that it's merged into what it is right now.
Can you tell us a bit about your own practice? Because you're an artist yourself. Did you always have a passion for that? Did you find that that was a part of that you could talk about your community and your voice as being a South Sudanese person coming to Australia?
Yes.
How did that evolve?
Well, in high school, as an immigrant, I couldn't speak English, but somehow I understood art, because art is this universal space that doesn't necessarily have a language, and you're able to understand it. And I found, I guess, solace in communicating how I felt by drawing, sketching, and that's how I would kind of figure out what I was feeling.
Yeah. Wow.
And then I realized, wow, this is a powerful thing. I can create a space where I can talk about these deep emotions and experiences, because at that time I struggled with writing English.
Yeah.
And over time, when my English got better and I was able to write and I was able to document in terms of journal writing, that transition into poetry writing and performance writing and storytelling.
Yeah.
And then it went into visual storytelling. So I got into photography, videography, and then it went into textiles. So I'm a multidisciplinary artist.
Yeah, yeah.
From high school, I've just really loved enjoying doing a lot of art making. I felt like I felt more connected to myself than other subjects. And then from that, I carried that out into the real world when I graduated and started really figuring out how to use art, I guess, as a skill, but not really to become an artist, because, you know, my immigrant mom was like, you're not going to be an artist. You're going to be a doctor. You're going to be a teacher. You're going to be something. But an artist, that is not a realistic thing.
Yeah.
And I guess that became like a rebellious challenge to be like, I'm going to show my mom that you can actually become something.
Yeah.
And you can actually make something out of yourself as an artist. And it's taken so long, but now she's seen all of the, I guess, the seeds that I've been planting.
Yeah.
And she's recognizing like, oh, okay, like, okay, yeah, this is nice. This is okay, you know?
I'm not actually struggling. Yeah. I am actually making ends meet as right. an artist in this space.
Right.
Back in Sudan, what is the art practice there? What is some traditional cultural things? Is it as it's seen through with women's making stuff or men making stuff? Like, how is that translated through your culture, and how are you translating that into Next in Colour?
Mm, I love that question, because art making, particularly in my culture, is really embedded in our traditional practices.
Yeah.
It's how we gather, how we celebrate in ceremony. You find women weaving and making beadworks and making textiles, and that creates that community gathering space, and that becomes an ancestral practice also. For us, because of just historically what we have endured, oral storytelling is the way that we archive and document the changes that happens within our community.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of poets in our community, because that is the only way we can record what goes on.
Yeah, yeah.
Singing, dance is such a really deep part of our cultural identity. It's a way that we honor our ancestors, is a way we connect to self.
Yeah.
So it's such a deep practice. Like, I can't not make art. I feel like it's just something that comes naturally to me because it's such a, I guess, yeah, a very spiritual embedded practice.
And is that, I mean, what you're saying there also sounds a lot what like Indigenous cultures in Australia yes. have is, do you feel that there's a kind of twining and connection between those two, even yes. though on the complete different parts of the world,
yes.
but have a similar way of their, as you say, the storytelling and keeping that not through writing, but through conversation and through messages and through the song line.
Yes. That I love how First Nations community practice art making as a way to build resilience.
Yeah.
And it's such a very beautiful way to see those cross-cultural connections and those intersections and similarities. And I guess for me, it really pushes me to really act as to be in solidarity with the community
yeah.
because I see the importance of preserving Indigenous art and putting that in the forefront in media because it talks also about the lived experience, the Black experience. Even though it's Indigenous experience, it still speaks to some of our experience.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's incredible when I see a lot of First Nations artists work, really talk about, I guess, land and water and connection to space, connection to spirit, and seeing that also as a practice that comes from Africa. So
yeah.
it's such a refreshing experience.
Yeah. Wow, that's a really beautiful analogy of those two. Such different parts of the world, but so similar and so connected. I mean, as they say, from the river to the sea and Palestine as well. But that brings me to the question about Footscray Community Arts. I mean, Footscray Community Arts is a centre which has that mixture of people that are Indigenous, people that are from the CLAD community, people that are queer, and like mm-hmm. them intersecting together. How did Next in Colour get involved with Footscray Arts, and how has it helped it, you know, launch itself as well?
Right. Well, through the Future Reset Project, which is a funded initiative by Vic Health,
yep.
Victoria Health Promotion, it opened up an opportunity for co-designing to occur where we asked the community, what do you want? And one of the key, I guess, things was around building community relationships with institutions and communities.
Yeah.
And for a lot of, I guess, marginalized communities post-COVID, it was really difficult for people to connect to third spaces because of isolation or, you know, 3 years of being in lockdown. And so Future Reset was that project of re-engaging community with space.
Yeah.
And that introduced an opportunity for Footscray to partner with a community-led grassroots organizations like Next in Colour to not only build their cultural literacy, the cultural, I guess, compliance, but also to learn how equity building looks like.
Yeah.
And it was an opportunity for us to share resources, networks, and also build a bridge between community and with an organization like Footscray.
Yeah, amazing. That's, yeah, super interesting way. How do you see, like, places like, I mean, yesterday I was talking to Opal, who works with Snuff Puppets and Women's Organization and FCA as well, and those intersections of different organizations. How do you see Next of Colour and Footscray Arts maybe dismantling the kind of stigma that's often associated with the West and the ideas of the communities of, you know, the African dysphoria in our spaces, which bring the most amazing food and stuff, but people that can be scared of that, not knowing what it is. How do these break maybe those barriers to others that don't live in this area?
Well, what I like about Future Reset, it put myself, you know, an African creative producer in the leadership role where I was the project coordinator that's dismantling power.
Yeah.
It also having a partnership with Next in Colour allowed Footscray to also tap into an ecosystem or communities that they would not have had access to. So that's also, you know, dispersing data, dispersing resources. It was the first time for a lot of people to actually come to this space, to Footscray, even though they've constantly been on the other side of the bridge or the other side of the station.
Yeah.
And so that also brings that community foot traffic where now people are re-engaging with this space through other programs.
Yeah.
Also, we put a lot of young people in the forefront to host, to present, to perform in different, I guess, through different collaborations and different partnerships. Like we had a partnership with NGV, with Arts Centre Melbourne, with Arts House. And we collaborated with an African-based, I guess, their architecture artist based in Kenya.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that really allowed young people to have experience in engaging with these institutions to build notoriety so that they can upskill on their vocational, I guess, skills as being artists or being, I guess, community art workers.
Yeah.
So I guess in terms of dismantling the unethical practices that happens in community art space, this partnership really demonstrated how shifting power is really important and also giving community the power and understanding that institutions like Footscray really need community to really function and giving community that autonomy to just do whatever they need to do to, I guess, to create that self-determination.
Yeah.
And that was a really important, I guess, experience for Footscray to let go of that control and let go of that power structure and really participate in this, I guess, cultural exchange now community wants to partner with Footscray because they recognize you've had this successful relationship with Next in Colour.
Yeah.
Then that means that, you know, we've created some sort of a, you know, I guess a foundation where we've equipped Footscray with a level of cultural literacy so they're able to work with community or resources of different organizations to tap into.
Yeah.
So it's not just them working with us, but working with another wider, I guess, encyclopedia of community organizations.
Yeah. And do you feel like, I mean, you're saying that you're doing your partnership with Art House, your partnership with the Arts Centre, your partnership with the NGV, you know, like no small feat, can I say? Like, damn.
The war on Palestine has not stopped. Palestinians need self-determination. Gaza must be free of Israeli occupation forces, have unconditional access to aid and reconstruction, the Israeli siege must end.
The West Bank needs the violence and attacks by the Israeli army and settlers to stop, and an end to the occupation and apartheid.
Your support to end the war on Gaza to bring peace, justice and freedom to all of Palestine is needed more than ever.
Join the rally on Sunday, the 11th of January, 12 noon, outside the State Library of Victoria, Swanson Street.
With your support, Palestine will be free, from the river to the sea.
Rally, Sunday, 11th of January, midday at the State Library. Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
Melinda here from On Screen, and we're taking
another holiday.
And On Screen will return on Saturday, the 24th of January at 11 a.m.
And do you feel like, I mean, you're saying that you're doing your partnership with Art House, your partnership with the Arts Centre, your partnership with the NGV, you know, like no small feat, can I say? Like, damn. But do you think that those organisations and this the kind of artist community now is really craving those, the African dysphoria community's voices, but just isn't quite sure where to tap that. Whereas maybe something like Next in Colour is for them like, oh, it's, we can understand it, we can read it, it's you know, easy enough to us. Do you feel that's part of it as well? And there's a problem in that, or that's a, you know, that's a good thing as well? What do you think about that?
I mean, we have to call it out sometimes and say that some of these institutions, you know, they have been operating in these dysfunctional, I guess, exploitative systems that really extract community, you know, work with them and then disperse them.
Yeah.
And so what a lot of our practices is really around self-determination, but also about accountability. And for us, we do understand as a new community of migrants, this society hasn't really adapted in how to engage with us.
Yeah.
So there isn't a lot of skills really implemented in how their systems work. And so for us, we really champion ourselves as an organization that comes with those tools and offer those tools through partnerships and collaborations. So these institutions are able to continue relationships with other organizations. And I think that's just the only way we're able to really create change is through those experiences and those continuous engagement. And it's intimidating because, you know, like an institution like NGV, you want to like, you know, like...
Oh my God, it's NGV.
But then it's a really important aspect because a lot of community members feel intimidated to enter spaces like NGV. Or even go and see an exhibition there. So to have an event there, it's also creating, you know, community safety. And it's dismantling that insecurity of feeling like, oh, I can actually belong in this space. Because I'm wanted to, you know, I'm wanted in this space. And that's a really important feeling of belonging. Because some people just think, oh, I have to be an artist to go to a gallery. Or I have to be like this type of person to engage with this space. But we're trying to normalize that. No, it's... It's for everybody.
And how do you, and like that's, I mean, that's a really interesting concept of actually making that space a safe thing for people. Because I mean, the NGV, like I walk past it every day going past work, and and a majority it's like either tourists from Asia or it's old white women who mean to fund the arts. But that really interesting way of, how do you bring community into a space and make it accessible for them without making you have to do all the work as community members to do that for those organizations? Do you think that's possible, or do you think that's just, that's another step?
It's possible. It's very exhausting. Because these institutions don't have bridges, we have to build those bridges. And then that that emotional tax. And then we have to also at the same time maintain those bridges. Because we, you know, we don't know who's going to come and exploit our community. And so there's a possibility of that existing. It just requires us to do a lot more work. And a lot of the times we ask these, any partners that we work with, anybody we collaborate with, is always an ask for them to meet us in the middle, because it's a shared experience and it's a shared value. And if we all both want the same thing, we have to both meet at the middle, so one person isn't doing all of the work. So, it's a 50-50 situation. And
it's going to take time. As everything does. And I want to talk about, you know, let's talk about the voice and visibility. How vital is it for Melbourne's African diaspora community to have platforms to share their voices, arts, and opinions? I mean, you've kind of touched on this in in essence before, but what do you think it does for people in the Australian community, but also for those Sudanese kids that have come out from a different place and trying to, you know, come into a new culture and fit in some way, you know?
Well, let's use this podcast, this recording as an example.
Go.
You might have some young people who get to listen to this. And then they identify my voice and they know me. And now they see, oh, Ruth is able to get into something like this and have an opportunity like this. Therefore, I can also get to that space. So in the practices that we do is giving the opportunity for young people to imagine themselves in those roles, in those spaces, and to see that it's a possibility. Because when we don't have that representation, then it's harder to see yourself in a space, because what are you using to imagine, to create that imagination? So kicking down doors is a really big thing, what we tend to do a lot of the times. Because we're not invited to the table, or if we are invited to the table, we're not offered a seat. So a lot of the times when we go to these spaces, we're able to turn around, tell, you know, the next person coming in, like, hey, you know, make sure you have this, you make sure you have that.
You have space here too. You're right. You are
Call
Australian
us if you need
as well.
Right.
We're here.
But also at the same time, what it does is it disrupts the stigma of what wider Australian perceive of the African community. I think it shows the determination that we have in building that second chance, but also it shows that we are citizens that are, I guess, implementing that. I don't know how to say it. It's like we're also contributing to society.
Ah, yeah.
And
yeah,
we have it so hard, but we're still in that practice. We're still pushing that and just showing that level of self-determination.
Yeah.
And showing that level of the need, because we're told that we don't belong here.
Yeah.
And so it makes it 10 times harder for us to do what we need to do for ourselves. But then we need to do it, because these spaces, you know, they're not just isolated to one community.
Yeah.
If spaces say we want diverse community, then we're going to have to be in the forefront in pushing that diversity. And yeah, I think voice is really important for the next generation to have some sort of archival materials to figure out what was this generation talking about?
Yeah.
What were the conversations they were having? And also, what are the conversations we're having too? So it's a need in many areas, in terms of documentation, in terms of representation, but also dismantling that stigma of what others perceive of us, maybe because of how the media has portrayed us. And it's great for young people also to see another identity for themselves too.
Yeah, I mean, touching on that, what you just said about the media, and as you walked in, you saying there's been two more killings of stabbings of South Sudanese boys in the outer western suburbs. I mean, how does your community deal with that pain and grief, and that, you know, as you're saying, that thing of they don't feel like they're not connected and belong and not given the space to be like, yeah, you're part of here as well, but they're isolated, and then these violent acts are happening to these young people. You know, what should Australians and the government and the communities do to help those people?
I don't think there's like a one-off kind of band-aid.
Yeah,
you know, it's a very complex experience and situation. Is very devastating. I think what Australians should do is to stop dehumanizing African and marginalized First Nations people, particularly when it comes to youth and, you know, and youth death. What's happened in the West, that narrative has dehumanized these young boys, these 12-year-old, 15-year-old boys,
so young,
and dehumanized them in a way that seems that their lives mean nothing.
Yeah.
And that is it's really disgusting, because it takes away the person. It takes away the grief of the family, but also the collective, I guess, domino effect.
Yeah.
And I guess for us in a community aspect, we've been mobilizing. We've been having conversations this whole week with state, federal government, with police, with schools, with different community organizations in what can we really create? What are the action plans that we need to develop? Because this is a problem that will require community, parents, institutions, and government to collaborate together and create a solution. This is not just for the government to create something.
Yeah.
It's something that requires everybody to participate in, because then if one space is creating a solution, then they may not echo the full, or they may understand the full capacity and how, I guess, violence is affecting our community. And, you know, we're new migrants. We're learning how to adjust. We're learning how to adapt. We're learning how to assimilate. And we're learning how to detach a lot from a lot of ancestral trauma.
Yeah.
And it's difficult for us, because not only are we learning how to adapt, we're dealing with racism.
Yeah.
And that is a very difficult experience, because it's almost like you're running, but it's like pouring rain.
Yeah.
You know, you're running on sand. It just feels like you're not moving anywhere. So it makes it difficult for a community to move past, because now we're fighting, you know, to humanize these deaths.
Yeah.
You know, instead of grieving.
Yeah.
We're going into media spaces and saying like, no, that's incorrect. That's an incorrect, you know, perspective, or incorrect, I guess, view on what you see. So it's a very heavy time, and you know, my thoughts and prayers to all communities in the African diaspora community here in Australia. And you know, it's post anti-immigration rally.
Yeah,
you know what we saw during that weekend, you know, the disruption, not only the violence that the individuals at Camp Sovereignty experience, you know, when we talk about young people dying, but we're also talking about, you know, First Nations young people also, and youth dying under police custody. So this is not just a situation that is affecting the African community.
Yeah.
This is a situation that has been affecting First Nations community and has trickled down to anyone who is marginalized.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a wider conversation that we need to have that, you know, because for us, if we are going to be empowered and government is going to support us, that support has to also be reflective to First Nations people.
Yeah.
And I think that the African and First Nations community need to come together and really collaborate in creating that change.
Yeah.
That's
amazing. I mean, not that long ago. I mean that he wasn't a child, but that African man that was killed next to Coles, like where we go every day to get our groceries.
Right.
To a man that was, and I remember seeing it on Phoney's Instagram story and thinking, why isn't this on the news? And it was a few days later that it was. But it's, you know, a man, and he has mental health stuff. There's two cops. He shows a knife, and they shoot and kill him in the middle of a very busy space, you know. And there was rallies post that of the community coming together and being like, this is not okay, you know. I've seen, as someone that's lived in Footscray, who have friends that are African or much darker complexions, that they get racially profiled every time with the cops in Footscray. And it's really disconcerting and kind of scary. And at times I'm like, I've been safe in a space because of my skin tone, because they're like, oh, she's, you know, she's white, it's okay, she can, you know, cross this border in, you know, the US and stuff. And I thought to myself for a second, I'm like, if I was a darker person, how would I deal with this moment? Like, it would be so much harder. So... I mean, that's a bigger question of that, of the West. But dark times. I want to talk about a bit more about your other stuff and there's the dark and there's the sad.
Yes.
But your other projects. I mean, you did another collaboration at the NGV, if I'm correct, called Ancestral Dissertations, is that correct?
Yes. Ancestral Dissertation.
Yeah, tell us a bit about that.
So Ancestral Dissertation is our current artistic programming at Next in Colour.
Yeah, okay, cool.
And so there are different pillars in how we activate that space. Yeah. So we have a pillar that is around, I guess, community gathering spaces. Then we have one that is around literature, so academic writings, zine books, you know, magazines, whatever it is, publications. And then there's another pillar that is around video work and audio work.
Okay.
And so we chose to activate the community gathering aspect of it by, I guess, creating community public programming with the African fashion exhibition that occurred last year. We activated three different separate days at NGV in creating different community programming at the Great Hall.
Yeah.
And that was really incredible to share our, I guess, lived experience and our stories to, I guess, the regular NGV visitor.
Yeah.
And it opened up space for our community and, I guess, like the wider community to connect with us.
Yeah.
And they were able to learn about African fashion and different materials, but also learn about how geography has really changed and influenced fashion in Africa.
Yeah.
And to work with an institution like NGV was incredible because we do things really non-traditional. So to work with people who are very system-based and we're like very fluid and loose and
see how it goes.
Yeah.
Just have a good time. Yeah.
It was a really great opportunity for us to create a program that not only educates about African fashion and textiles. We had a pop-up studio-like photography, I guess, opportunity. So it's an influence of like studio photography art.
Wow.
And we had Giskeva's mom created and hand-stitched two African printed materials.
Oh my God.
And people were able to take photos and learn about the different, I guess, history of Kente, which is mostly the East African materials. And then we had a young, we had a zine making workshop with young people, with young little kids, in using, you know, making a zine out of, I guess, African cloth.
Yeah.
And it was just interesting, kids just chopping up things, pasting things. And that was a great way for us to not only educate one demographic of people in terms of age, but also to engage with like little kids.
Inspire.
And to educate them also about African art. And, you know, for them, they were just asking us questions about safari because that's what they know. So it was good to now add another fact into their understanding of Africa.
There is more than the Lion King to Africa.
We got fabrics over here.
Yeah. We got art. We got food. We've got culture. Yeah. Oh my God. That's Wow. People in Australia. I mean, that's the thing about Australia that I've heard from other people from African backgrounds who've said that they feel like they feel more comfortable in places like Paris, like in Europe, in terms of England or France, because there's not much of a big population there compared there is in Australia, which is seems to mostly be in Melbourne.
Yes.
Do you see that that's a deterrent for people wanting to come to Australia because places like the UK and that have a higher population of people of community?
I think it's a migration thing.
Yeah.
You, people, I guess when you look at the African diaspora community in the UK, you have 1 to 5 generations of African immigrants there.
Yeah.
And then here you have 1 to 2 generations. So we have only been here for, I think, less than 50 years.
Yeah.
So we haven't really built that infrastructure and we haven't really developed that cultural identity because we still identify ourselves on an ethnical level. And here in Australia, everybody identifies on a national level.
Yeah.
So we're learning how to blend those cultural identities together to create that third space. And I think that I think in the next decade or so, there's going to be a huge surge of new artists and new emerging artists and new talent. And I think that's going to bring that tourism here because the African-Australian experience is a new experience that globally people don't really recognize.
Yeah.
I have fam members who have migrated to the UK and they're always like, is there black people down there? You know, like there's, because, and it's not just in the UK, it's also in America.
Yeah.
When I have American friends that come down here, they get surprised because it's like, it's the down under, you know? There's no conception.
Blonde and blue eyes and sitting by the beach.
Right. Yeah. So we don't have that mainstream representation, but slowly we're slowly getting there. I mean, you have the AFL that is now slowly being dominated by South Sudanese athletes.
Good. And they're so fast. I'm like, oh my God, he's gone. He's disappeared with the ball.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's a great way of showing that global representation.
Yeah.
And then you have the modeling industry where you have Aduda Ketch, who is an incredible international supermodel who is on the cover of Vogue, Australia Vogue, like 6 times. So that itself is also that international coverage where slowly, I guess, international communities are recognizing, hey, there's a community here.
Yeah.
And we need to figure out what's going on there. And I guess, like I said, the more representation that we create, the more noise, the more that we're seen and put out there in the mainstream space, the more the global diaspora community is able to come here also and learn about our lived experience.
Yeah.
Because all we know is African Europeans experience or African American experience or African experience, but not really about African Australian experience.
Yeah.
So I think it's a migration thing. We're new here and we haven't been here for a long time. So I think, over time, I hope we're able to build that infrastructure.
Yeah. I mean, I think a really important thing that I love about Melbourne is that even Vietnamese and Greek communities that have been here, you know, there's Greeks living in Abbotsford that still don't speak English.
Right.
And they've lived here for like 60 years.
Right.
And they have newspapers and they have – so I love that the fact that Melbourne, while having all these different cultures and communities, there's still people that, A, do want to integrate, and there's others that go, no, actually, I'm going to keep speaking Vietnamese and not speak anything else.
I think that's why the anti-immigration protests really, I guess, irritated me, because – Australia is a melting pot.
Yeah.
And you have such a diverse range of different migrant communities, Greeks, Italian, Vietnamese, South Asian, African.
English people, English. Who actually aren't from Australia originally.
They themselves are immigrants. They're migrants.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Descendants of the 12th Fleet or whoever. Whatever boat.
James Cook Fleet thing, right. Something, you know.
And I think the culture of the multiculturalism of Melbourne really sets us out in different states, because we engage with each other.
Yeah.
We integrate with each other. You see the South Asian and African community integrating. You see the Asian and African community integrating. Like, there's a lot of integration that is happening, and that's what sets us apart. And that's multiculturalism is really important also for culture.
Yeah.
Right? For new things to be discovered. You know, you have Footscray, you have people who are going to Ethiopian restaurants and first time in trying out East African, you know, cuisine, and that is an experience of itself. So, you know, the same way you have Indian cuisine that dominates, you know, culinary spaces, sooner or later, hopefully African cuisine also is there. And so it's just a part of that integration, you know, like one day.
Will there be a buttered chicken of African food?
Maybe there'll be like some fufuna, you know, some, you know, something, you know, panda yam, something, you know. Shout out to our Nigerian people, maybe something, you know. But I think slowly, I think the more that we work and build, the more that we see ourselves taking up spaces in different areas and showing our culture. And I feel like that's how, I guess, white Australians are going to be able to appreciate us.
Yeah.
Because we don't really have spaces, or I don't think there's ever been anything huge where we can showcase our culture and demonstrate that and invite people to engage. And so that they can feel like they're also a part of that community and that ecosystem, even though they're just there in solidarity with us. Like, at least they can see our culture.
Yeah.
And so art making becomes that space where we're able to show our culture in a different way.
Yeah.
So that people can come to galleries, come to community spaces and see it for themselves and then evaluate from themselves.
I mean, as a white Australian, as a dad who is an immigrant who's lost in himself where he is, I think with white Australians is that we don't actually have a connection to anything. Like, we're not English. Like, some of us have never, I've never been to England, but like my ancestors come from there. Our culture is set up in the idea of that football is as a holiday, and Jesus, but most white Australians aren't even a Christian, or they're not Catholic. So, like, I think in this saying this is that we are maybe threatened by the fact that for Sudanese communities and African communities, they have such a deep and historical connection to place, to who they are, to where they're from, same as Indigenous communities. And, you know, a lot of white Australians, we just kind of sit in this middle place that we don't really connect to anything. So for some people who, I think, you know, those men that, you know, awful, the neo-Nazi men on the streets, they don't know where they belong.
Exactly, yeah. I think belonging is such a huge point in fitting into a society.
Yeah.
And I definitely do recognize that Australian society, I try to figure out what Australian culture is. Is it beers? Is it the pub?
Is it
having a Palmer at the pub? Is it, like you say, is it AFL? Is it this? Like, I think that white Australians should take immigration and multiculturalism as an opportunity for them to create their own culture and differentiate themselves from Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, no one is going to go back to Europe. No one is leaving.
No.
We're all going to be here. So how do we share this space is by white Australians creating their own identity, their own cultural identity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we see those neo-Nazis operating in that place of violence, because if we have to be realistic, what you have attached to is colonialism, yeah. is violence,
yeah.
and war.
Yeah.
And it's yet you feel embarrassed to be attached to something like that. So you create this imaginary place. And yeah. it's like, what are you fighting for,
yeah.
really? You know, and how dare you go and disrupt sacred space also?
Yeah.
So, but I think that both parties, both communities can learn from each other. You know, we can learn about white Australian culture because, like you say, they sit in that third space. We're in an environment as African communities where some of us are rejecting our own cultural practice because some of it doesn't really make sense for it to be practiced here.
Yeah.
Like patriarchy, like really not being successful and centering men and having kids, and that's the only thing you can do.
Yeah.
And we have to, as women, I guess, fight against that patriarchal structure and be like, wait, I'm going to go and get education. I'm going to go and be successful and create a business. Yeah. I'm not going to think about just living my life as a wife.
Yeah.
So we're readapting and rechanging aspect of our culture so we're able to create, I guess, that success and that space where we're integrating new practices because, yeah, some of the things that were created as survival.
Yeah.
And what our parents practiced only was, I guess, functional in Africa.
Yeah.
You can't perpetuate those things here because it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's a different reality. So we're in a third space also.
Yeah.
And we're not rejecting our cultural, traditional, you know, I guess, practices, but we're just challenging them and creating something that is a lot more sustainable for us.
Well, that's a really interesting thing that you're saying because I think there's also this really set understanding that culture is always the same. Mm. The tradition is always the same.
Mm.
The thing about culture, and I mean, look at Indigenous people, they've lived on the land for 60,000 years plus. We don't know how long. They've had to adapt over that time in terms of even just the land they live on has changed in those conditions.
Mm.
Culture is always adapting and changing for survival, basically.
Right.
Like
right.
we do with animals, but in our own culture. So that's a really interesting thing that you've said of that comparison of you want to kind of keep the essence of your African heritage and the things that you go, that really works with me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also a woman living in the West and I've been given the opportunity to go, I don't want to get married and have a husband. I want to go to school.
Yeah.
Does that relate to you, that thing of the adaption of culture?
Yeah, culture, it's inevitable for culture to not change, or it has to change.
Yeah.
Because it changes by people's consciousness. You know, we came here and as young people, we got educated compared to our parents who've never got some sort of education. So the way we see the world is different for my parents.
Yeah.
And so the way that we see culture and respond to it is different. And it has to always change. I mean, when you hear like scientists and you hear business people using the word innovation, innovation is part of adapting into a space.
Yeah.
And culture is a phenomenal thing that we can't really describe what it is, right? So we can't, it has to change because when we, like, let's say, for example, even our accent, even how I speak, I don't have a strong African accent, right? But then you have my mom who's equally has been here the same time as me, and she has a heavy African accent. Culture has changed because now my dialect has changed.
Yeah.
The way I enunciate things have changed. The way I speak my traditional language has changed. And it's not a bad change. It's just us adapting into this society because, like there's some aspects that are just going to naturally and organically change.
Yeah.
And for us, even when we talk about ethnic identity, tribalism, a lot of us young people don't perpetuate tribalism. We tend to really mix around different tribes, particularly in the South, South Sudanese communities. But with our older parents, they don't even go, they would never even consider going and hanging out with somebody who's from a different tribe.
Wow.
Because they're still indoctrinated into that practice.
Yeah.
And then you have this whole different generations of people that don't see that as something to be perpetuated. Because it's like, at the end of the day, the system sees us as immigrants.
Yep.
The system sees us as African.
Yep.
They don't care you're from Sheerlung or you're from, you know, Twitch Mayadi. They don't care where...
They don't know.
They don't know you're from Panaru, you know. Yeah. They don't know you're from this sub-tribe in South Sudan.
Yeah.
So for us in this Western world, we see our tribalism is a colonial practice that keeps us separated. And the way that we can mobilize is us identifying... there's nothing, you know, like it's almost like me hating on you because you live in Footscray and I live in Pakenham.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be like, oh, beast, the Footscray girl. It's like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
I'm going to eventually come to Footscray one day, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, what's the purpose of practicing something that is not going to take us to a place of success?
Yeah.
Or a place where we can pivot and create that innovative change?
Yeah. Oh, you're amazing. You know that. What you're doing is incredible. The essence of the both. I love that thing of you're keeping the culture up but adapting to change and teaching your elders, as you were saying before when right. you were coming in, talking to them about what's happening in the community and these young people dying.
Mm.
You need young people to have those conversations yeah. as well.
I mean, I learn a lot from First Nations communities where being an elder is not defined by age.
Yeah.
You have a 12-year-old who's an elder of community.
Yeah.
And that, I guess, hierarchical structure has also influenced the way I exist in community, the yeah. way I enforce change in community. And with everything that's happening with our community, I've been saying in the forefront that women, mothers and kids and young people need to be in the forefront.
Yeah.
That we don't need to hear from men. Like, be there to protect us, but let us lead.
Give us the space to have the voice.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's really important because it's often that men are the ones dictating and choosing and creating and negotiating on our behalf.
Yeah.
And then missing some critical aspects that only a mother can speak of.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
the devastation of those two boys who've been lost is the mothers that are feeling that deep pain, you know, and their voice aren't going to be heard because it's going to be the men going to the forefront speaking.
Yeah.
And so a lot of things you have to kind of fight for it to change and shift so that the people who don't typically get the space to speak will get the space to speak because they're the ones who have something vital to say. If we've been hearing the same story, we have to change.
Yeah, you have to change something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because you say about the mothers in that story, which haven't really, I mean, I'm, was looking at ABC today on the news and it's about the boys and what happened. Mm-hmm. But you look at the police shootings up in Pakapanyo, whatever it's called, where the guy killed two cops. The whole article is the grieving mother and the children in the church at the funeral doing that. And this kind of way that the media humanizes the policeman, who is a person in a very bad, system that is racist and homophobic and got lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that you say that, like, that the voices of the women, that's not so much seen in the media. Do you agree with that?
It's definitely not seen. I think there's that hyper representation of men in our community being in the forefront of talking about devastation.
Yeah.
And sometimes, yes, it's needed because then, maybe women are grieving privately in their own space. However, I feel as though women should have been and are going to be in the forefront in dealing with a lot of these devastating situations that are happening in the world. And when it comes to media representation, I mean, we're seeing it in Gaza.
Yeah.
We're seeing the dehumanization and, I guess, misrepresentation and misinformation of what is truly happening there and the media coverage. So when a marginalized community is experiencing devastation, it's often white media that is creating this narrative that we're not, we're not human and we don't feel and we don't have emotions.
Yeah.
We don't feel devastation because we're from a war-torn country, which is, to me, is ridiculous because you have white Australians that celebrate Anzac Day.
Mm.
And Anzac Day is a celebration of of two wars that have occurred. It's just the difference between white Australians and African is our war happened in our own backyard.
Yeah.
And the war that happened with white Australians happened elsewhere.
Yeah.
And so they don't know that environmental devastation of experiencing war, being a byproduct of war in your face.
Yeah.
And so And you, like I said, Anzac Day, not to even disrespect what those soldiers have sacrificed for this land, but also to say that you have a day that people celebrate, you know, the championing of, you know, of surviving a war and the people who've sacrificed their lives for this country, who noble men and women and First Nations people who really went to the forefront.
Yeah.
And that is war.
Yeah.
You know, Australians are a byproduct of war.
Yeah.
You have a generation of people who are traumatized, vets who are byproduct of war.
Yeah.
So it's really ridiculous when you see one narrative that is glamorizing survivors of war, and then you have people who are refugees who come from nothing, who don't have a day to celebrate the fact that they survived.
Yeah.
And instead of championing their survival and their resilience, is speaking negatively and saying this about them and not knowing that some of us came from hunger. Some of us saw people die right in front of us.
Yeah.
And some of us lived in refugee camps. Some of us, it's our first time to even live in a physical house because of where we come from.
Yeah.
And so that should be a demonstration of the strong resilience of our community.
Yeah.
And we just want to be seen.
Yeah.
And we want to belong because we have the capacity to really progress as a community, as a marginalized community.
And that's what Next in Colour is.
Yes.
And I just wanted to kind of wrap this up. I'm just thinking about, what do you see the future of Next in Colour? What is the biggest goal you can think of? Where do you want it to go? What do you want it to be? And and how do you think you're going to get there? Just a simple question. Just a simple question to end you off. But just think of something that how you inspire it to see it. Like you see it, not necessarily its end goal, because obviously going to keep evolving.
Right.
But to get to a place where it's, I mean, it already is thriving in an amazing way, but maybe to reach more community people in different areas.
Well, our strategic plan is to eventually get to a space where we have a physical community hub space that is created for community by community. Even though there's a lot of community art space like Footscray, like Western Edge, like all these different youth and community and art spaces, there isn't one that is just for and by African community.
Yeah.
And when I think about the future, I think about the importance of third spaces, the importance of centers like this, and the importance of really creating that level of infrastructure.
Yeah.
Because then we're able to govern that space instead of council governing it, instead of, you know, a community of people who are not from our community governing it. It's us creating that space.
Yeah.
So I would love, in a hypothetical world,
if you had a magic wand and you could do what you want.
Right. And I think a lot of that has to be with us, how to achieve that. I think government support around infrastructure, community coming together and, you know, putting our money where, you know,
our mouth is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And us really disciplining ourselves in that dream. And also just continuously doing the work that we're doing so that we're just slowly building those partnerships. Because the more that we work with different institutions, the more we build that notoriety and the more that we can stand out. I mean, I'm so, I guess, inspired by even Footscray turning 50.
Yeah.
You know, I think about the pioneers of this space 40 years ago. Next in Colour is about to be 10 in 2028.
Wow.
And so you look at Footscray, who has been existing, you know, 40 plus years than us, but it started off with pioneers. It started off with change makers.
Yep.
Started off by people who had a dream and a passion to community engaged practice, especially in the arts. And so we look at these spaces as a possibility of something coming out of this dreaming.
Yeah.
And I just want us to just, you know, be more in the mainstream space, you know, take up more space.
I have no doubt that you are going to get there and you're going to create something amazing.
Thank you.
The work that you do is super inspiring and, people would be hitting themselves in the head if they don't. So thank you so much for being a part of this and sharing your story.
Thank you.
It's really inspiring to see. And I think even for myself, just in this moment of so much – terrible stuff happening, hearing about Next in Colour and those kind of organisations kind of gives you hope for the future for younger people.
Yeah. I think that's why we do what we do.
Yeah.
Because in a place of chaos, sometimes you don't see like the end goal. You don't see the destination. And so we want to be that beacon of hope for community where we pick up the pieces when everything is falling apart.
Yeah.
And because then if we don't have initiatives like Next in Colour, then we don't have a base foundation for community. And it's not just Next in Colour that is doing work. It's other communities in the West, in the East, in the North, all over Victoria.
Yeah.
And so for us, it's just us. We just want to create, you know, something. We want to carve out something for ourselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't care how hard it is. You know, we're hungry.
You're
going
to get there. I mean, you had an idea to make an organization. You're like, let's get some people together to make art from these communities. And now you're like, and 10 years later, here we are. So watch your space. It's going to go on. But thank you so much. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to my TED Talk.
You've been listening to West Side Stories, a podcast dedicated to the voices and stories of Melbourne's West. As we wrap up this episode, I want to extend my heartfelt thanks to my partner, Ruben Cumming, who engineered the podcast and composed the theme music. I'd also like to thank Footscray Community Arts for the generous use of their podcast studio and for supporting the vibrant, inspiring community